Welcome to WPFW Washington, D.C. at 89.3 FM at WPFWFM.org. This is the hour of We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone. We've been bringing you jazz and justice for well over 47 years. If you're a new listener or a longtime listener, you know that we are listener dependent, but more properly put, in right relationship with you, the listener. We are entirely listener supported, both by your financial wherewithal, but your social connectivity as well. I have to do household duties at this point at every quarter and tell you that I need to earn more than $500 in this hour to properly support this station, to keep us 50,000 watts strong so we can reach over Baltimore and into Delaware, out to West Virginia, out to the Eastern Shore, and down into Northern Virginia. But reaching out is not the only thing. It's connecting with you about jazz and justice. Won't you become a member today? Help me raise the $500 or more in this hour by calling 1-800-222-9739. 1-800-222-9739. So without further delay, we put the proper focus, the more important focus, on our guest. And we're going to pose the question: when freedom is the question, abolition is the answer. What is freedom? How do we get free? What are the freedom dreams that encourage us and drive us forward? And how do we embrace freedom, importantly, collectively? So it's all about freedom, and our guest is Bill Ayers. Bill Ayers is an engaged scholar and peace and social justice activist who has written extensively about social justice and freedom, democracy and education, the cultural context of schooling, very important, and about teaching as an essentially intellectual, ethical, and political enterprise. He's also the host of the podcast Under the Tree, a seminar on freedom. Mr. Ayers' books include A Kind and Just Parent, Fugitive Days, a memoir, Public Enemy, Confessions of an American Dissident, and his latest work, again, When Freedom is the Question, Abolition is the Answer. Good morning, Bill. Welcome.
Good morning, David. It's a delight to be with you. And before we start, I'd like to say one thing, which is I want to echo what you said in your fundraising appeal. And that is that in a period of time when the public is being decimated and the public space disappeared, we need you, David, and we need WPFA more than ever. WPFW, sorry, more than ever. And so when I get off this Zoom with you, I'm going to call 1-800 800-222-9739. I'm going to pledge $100, so you only need 400 more.
Well, thank you, Bill. I'm very grateful for that. You're a generous heart, and you're going to prove that. I challenge you during this hour. For some longtime listeners, for some seasoned folk here in the metropolitan D.C. area, your name rings familiar. And it's been an encouragement. It's an honor to have you here today. I just want to say that up front.
Thank you. It's delightful to be.
It's also important that I start on the right foot. And I mentioned that you do this podcast, and the name Malik Alum, excuse me, is very important. Can you tell us the story behind the podcast? And let's see if we can honor Malik this morning.
Yeah. The book, When Freedom is the Question, Abolition is the Answer, evolved from my podcast. And I'll tell you, I started this podcast, I don't know, 5, 6 years ago with Malik Alim, who was a leader of Black Lives Matter Chicago, a leader of the Let Us Breathe Collective, a leader of the Breathing Space. And he really taught me a lot about how to do it. His brother-in-law, Damon Williams, and his colleague, Daniel Kisslinger, taught me how to do it. Actually, when my podcast started, my 12-year-old granddaughter was one of the hosts, and along with Malik and myself. And she said to me one day, you know, every adult man I know has a podcast. And I said, yes, they're like weeds. They spring up. But Malik was a special, talented, brilliant young man and a real organic leader of the movement in Chicago. He died tragically in a boating accident 3 years ago.
Sorry.
Yes, and he the boat capsized in Wisconsin. He had his 3-year-old and his 2-year-old with him. They were wearing life vests, and they popped to the surface and were saved, and Malik went to the bottom and died. And so we paused the podcast for a period. But this book is dedicated to the memory of Malik, and I think about him every day. He did some phenomenal work in his short life, and a reminder that a life can be short and still full. And he made a huge difference in Chicago, and I think for all of us. So thank you for mentioning Malik.
Oh, you're more than welcome. And the notion of under the tree, I think it's worthy of explaining to people why that title.
Yeah. Malik and I had several conversations about what to call our burgeoning idea of a podcast when we began. And, you know, what we were drawing on, we knew that we wanted to focus on freedom. And we knew that freedom was a complex, multi-layered, contested concept in American minds. And so we wanted to focus there. And we wanted to invite people onto the podcast who were freedom fighters, either freedom fighters from old or freedom fighters from right now. And however you think of that, we wanted to bring people on who were part of building a social justice movement. And every time we had a guest on, we would end by saying, well, what does freedom mean? And the idea was, you know, to get a robust conversation going. And the book extends off of that premise. But Under the Tree is a reference back to the freedom schools in Mississippi in 1964. And if you don't know that story, you can always find it online. The curriculum of the Mississippi Freedom Schools is online. It's called, just look up Mississippi Freedom Schools 1964, and a whole curriculum is there. But the idea of the Mississippi Freedom Schools was that the idea originated with a group of people, but Charlie Cobb wrote the proposal. He was a SNCC volunteer, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee volunteer from Howard University. And Charlie wrote a proposal, and he said, the Black people of Mississippi have been denied many things, and school children have been denied many things, forward-looking curriculum, decent facilities, fully trained teachers, but the fundamental injury is they've been denied the right to think for themselves about the circumstances of their lives and how they might be otherwise. Now, that's a mind-blowing sentence when you say it out loud, because you could add today, you could say the children of Washington, D.C., the children of the West Side of Chicago have been denied many things, and you could list all the things they've been denied, but the end is the killer. They've been denied the right to think for themselves about the circumstances of their lives and how they might be otherwise. Things, your circumstances may seem permanent, but they're not. So how might be, and that was a revolutionary idea in 1963 in Mississippi. And if you don't believe it was revolutionary, then think back to the martyrs of Mississippi, Goodman, Schwerner, and Cheney, were investigating the arson bombing of a freedom of a church that hosted a freedom school when they were kidnapped and lynched. So it had revolutionary implications. But why under the tree? Because Charlie argued, and the SNCC people and the SCLC people and the Highlander people brought this to life. And that was that a freedom school can meet anywhere. It doesn't have to be in a brick and mortar kind of classroom. Could be in a church basement, could be in a community center, could even meet under a tree in a park. And that's the image that we wanted to generate, that freedom and teaching freedom and learning freedom doesn't, it could be on a picket line. It could be in a walkout or an encampment. That's where freedom comes to life. And so we use the image of under the tree to signify that when freedom is the question and abolition is the answer, you don't need a venue other than what's right in front of you.
Well, to extend the spirit of abolition, you know, I think of the hush harbor among enslaved Africans who out of their own agency, out of their own humanity, out of their own impulses, shared with each other and learned from each other. I think of Carter G. Woodson being answerable to Black men of his community by being in the barbershop, reading newspapers, discussing issues. It's a long, long legacy that we live under, and we should be proud of it and hold on to it.
You think of the Highlander Folk School and the whole generation of that, Bernice Johnson, I believe, yes, her name was. But the whole idea was that we teach each other. We don't need some certified expert. We can learn from each other. We can learn from our own experiences. And we can, importantly, learn by doing. I'm glad you referenced that enslaved community because, you know, Fred Moten once said that our freedom dreams were born in the hold of a slave ship. And I often think, I mean, I take solace and encouragement from lots of things. But in Illinois, when we did away with the death penalty and led the nation 20 years ago in doing away with the death penalty, the energy for that movement sparked inside death row. It wasn't some brilliant person from outside who thought it up. It was the guys on death row organized themselves into a legal studies class. And as they met, they realized that they shared certain circumstances. Not only were they condemned to die by the state of Illinois, but several of them had been tortured by a particular police unit in Chicago, and they were tortured confessions. And as they realized this, they organized themselves into a group called the Death Row 10. That led to the Mothers of the Death Row 10, which led to a movement, including a radio show like yours, but it was called Live from Death Row. And guys would call out and we would broadcast it in churches and so on. Well, we eventually built a movement to obliterate the death penalty, death by execution. We still have death by incarceration in Illinois. But I'm just underlining your point. Our freedom dreams come out of the darkest places, and we should not be discouraged into thinking we can't do more because we can. If it came out of a slave ship or it came out of death row, well, what's holding you and me back?
Well, you're making things abundantly clear so early on. Thank you. Here's the thing. Words are important. Rhetoric's important. The spirit of speech one to another is important. So last night, certain national presidential candidate comes on a big stage, and there are at least two gigantic banners with the word freedom on a lovely blue background. And I'm sure you've been asked. I witnessed you in Baltimore, so shout out to Red Emma's, and thank you for Baltimore for always having a book fest that can be indeed described as radical. So you get asked this question, Bill, I'm sure often, what is freedom? How do you define it? I'm not a mainstream person, so I'm not asking you the cheesy question. I'm tossing you the softball, expecting your response.
Well, that's really what the book delves into, because the concept of freedom, the word freedom, is practically appliqued on our American minds. Everyone's for freedom. And as you know, the Civil War was fought for freedom. And most people, when you say that, say, yeah, it was fought to free the enslaved African workers. But in reality, read the documents. The Confederacy was fighting for freedom. What freedom were they fighting for? The freedom to own human beings, which was their tradition, which was their legacy. The freedom to make their own decisions away from a federal government that they felt was overreaching. So they used the word freedom. Everyone uses the word freedom. We have, you know, the Freedom Unlimited Visa card, and we have the Freedom Caucus and the insufferable Ron DeSantis with his courage to be free. So everyone uses the word, but what do we mean? And I don't think I can easily, and I don't even want to come up with a dictionary definition. What I want to say is that, and the whole book is an attempt to get at an answer to your question. But the idea is that freedom, you notice the subtitle, Reflections on Collective Liberation, because usually when in America we use the word freedom, we mean my freedom, we mean individual freedom, and we talk as individualists because we live in a toxically individualist culture. But the reality is freedom for the wolf is also murder for the lamb. And that's important to remember, because the freedom to drill, the freedom to kill, the freedom to invade, the freedom to occupy, that's not the freedom we're talking about. We're talking about collective freedom, community freedom. We're talking about identifying obstacles to our humanity and then moving against those obstacles. So in one part of the book, I begin by describing when I was arrested in, I've been arrested many times, but I was arrested in Chicago in 1968 at the, you know, iconic Democratic Party. I was arrested a couple times at their convention. But one time I was arrested was in Grant Park across in downtown Chicago, beaten up, bloodied, put in a police van, and on my way to county jail with 11 other people who'd been beaten and bleeding, we felt ecstatic. We felt free. Why did we feel free? That's ironic. But the reason we felt free is because we had put our shoulders to the wheel against unfreedom, against war, against white supremacy, against racism. And because we had done that collectively, we felt this almost ecstasy at linking arms and linking hearts and saying, we're going to move against what's killing us, and we're going to move against it forcefully and do our best. We're going to try. Of course, we failed, but then we tried again and failed again, but hopefully failed better. And that's, I think, what the rhythm of movement making is about. We try and we name an obstacle to our full liberation. We move against that obstacle, and we try collectively to bring about a better state of affairs, more balance, more peace, more justice, more love in the community, away from predation and war and exploitation and oppression. And that's what I think freedom, that's how I think about freedom. That's how I was inducted when I was 18 years old into the freedom movement.
So to honor the book in a very good sense, it's 8 essays. And we are not leaving this hour without really talking about the importance of teaching, but the book models this so well. It's a, you know, it's a slim volume, but it's really cogent. It's really powerful. And one of the things you do is, and you can talk about this throughout the interview, Bill. You start out with poems, and as a teacher would, you give us assignments. And I need to tell you that, I certainly tried them. And so there's something to be said about being intentional, about summoning discipline. And, you illustrated it just now in your answer, but I just want to do a strategic reiteration here to have some appreciation of freedom, to spread it, to plant it, to grow it. You have to look at unfreedom, and you have to ask certain questions once you look at it. What are those questions?
Well, I think, you know, for me, you identify unfreedom as a way to be free. And I'm arguing, you know, David, that freedom is not in and of itself sitting on your couch smoking a joint. I mean, I'm all for it. You can do that. But that's not where freedom comes to life. Where freedom comes to life is when you're in action against unfreedom. So if unfreedom includes failing broken down segregated schools, freedom must mean in part moving to build, you know, schools that work for all of our children. If unfreedom is restrictions on your right to vote, freedom must mean in part the ability to vote, you know, broadly, freely. So I begin, please come to Busboys and Poets, 14th and V, on November 14th at 6 p.m.
I want to do a special shout out to teachers. There are many progressive teacher groups here in D.C., as you probably know. Teaching for Change is one that comes to mind right away. And I know teachers listen to this hour. Sometimes they listen through our archives or a podcast. Other times they're listening live if they can at 11 on a Wednesday morning. But and this hour is just a short snapshot. I have to really sing praises about your life's work. And in this book, you really make it compelling. The whole enterprise of teaching, the student and the teacher appearing to one another, of working with one another. It's very evident in this book. People need to gather the notion that you've opened up a world of poetry. You've done a pretty good job picking a variety of poets. And I just can't say enough. We are so conditioned, and this here comes the question, Bill, is coming. We're so conditioned by some sort of conventional understanding of poetry, of teaching. You know, we all make our jokes about how we got through literature in high school, and either we were turned off from fiction or nonfiction, or we were turned on to it, or we have a wonderful retrospective perspective as an adult. Let the now be now. Enjoy teaching. Enjoy living. Enjoy being active for justice for people. That's why Bill Ayres is here. That's why other guests have been here. That's why we talk about race, politics, history, and culture on We the People. We need your support, listeners. You spent a lot of time about knocking down individualism, and there were many different points. And one of them was how the individualism even skews our society and structures. You talk about budgets, how we spend so much money on things that don't really help humanity. I'm going to make it open-ended. Talk about it. Why did you spend so much time on the me-ism, on the individualism part?
Well, you know, I think that there's a dialectic in all lives between me and we. And I think we have skewered in our political life and in our culture towards an exclusive, you know, focus on me to the detriment of the community. And I think, and you can see it in a thousand ways, income inequality, differential health outcomes, what schools you go to, educational outcomes, and so on. But I think that what's important is that if we become so individualistic, then we begin to say things like, well, public health, that means stay healthy. Public safety, own a gun. Public schools, it's a market that you have to buy into. In fact, the word public has been racialized. You know, so when we think of public housing, public welfare, when you say public welfare, you're not talking about tax cuts to sports stadiums. You're obviously talking about the Black community. So I think we have to kind of examine. You said how important words are, and I really think that's true. Thinking is the first act of resistance. But I think that we need to overcome this strict focus on the individual. And we need to understand that the community, the health of the community, is a requirement for the health of the individual. And I make the argument in teaching all the time that the greatest, you know, that the greatest accomplishment of each individual requires the accomplishment of the whole community, and vice versa. So I'm trying to argue that we need to get over an exclusive focus on the individual and begin to think more clearly, more robustly about what's good for the community. And it's very clear from research, from common sense, that a healthy community makes individuals more healthy more of the time. And I mean healthy in the broadest sense. But you mentioned teaching and learning, and I want to just say one thing about that. You know, I am a lifelong teacher. Most of my writing and most of my work has been in education. And you know, it's funny because if you jump into education fully, you see every other problem, war, racism, gender, everything. But my wife, who founded a center at Northwestern University Law School called the Children F Family Justice Center, she says the same with the law. You jump into children's law and you make the connections, you can see everything clearly: racism, sexism, war, you know, capitalism. It all becomes clear. But I'm making an argument here. I partly draw on the freedom schools, which we talked about earlier, but I'm making an argument that we need to think about teaching, we need to think about learning much more broadly than we tend to think about it. I'm arguing away from both an individualistic idea of educational accomplishment, but also I'm arguing against a kind of a rational, testable kind of approach to teaching and learning. What I argue again and again is that the message to our students has to be: you have every right to be here. You have every right to inquire into the world. And in fact, you need no one's permission to interrogate the world. And that's a hugely important message at a time of book burning and restrictions. And, you know, here I am teaching at Stateville Prison, and I'm saying to my students, you need no one's permission to interrogate the world. You don't need mine. You don't need your parents. You don't need the warden. You have a right to interrogate the world. Otherwise, what is freedom? And the freedom to think, the freedom to learn, the freedom to teach. I'm suddenly thinking of one of your Baltimore natives, Ta-Nehisi Coates. In his first book, The Beautiful Struggle, he makes a wonderful argument about why he was made for the library and not the classroom. And what he means by that is, I want to interrogate, I want to read, I want to understand. I don't want to follow somebody else's script. In fact, I heard Ta-Nehisi speak in Chicago years ago, and one young aspiring woman who was an aspiring writer asked him, "What should I read? What should my reading list be?" And Coates, in form, in the tradition that he believes in, Coates said, "If I gave you my reading list, it wouldn't be helpful. You have to develop your own reading list." So my advice to you is, go into the library, pick up a book and read it, and ask, "What book does it now demand that I read?" This is very much the way I think that we should be thinking of teaching and learning. One last point, David, is that I was very disappointed during the encampments on the colleges and the universities. Those were examples of freedom schools, the encampments for Gaza on the various campuses. And what was disappointing was watching university presidents from the most prestigious universities go in front of committees run by know-nothings and grovel, not only grovel, but be unable, apparently, to give a full-throated defense of academic freedom, meaning the freedom to teach and the freedom to learn. It's way beyond the First Amendment. Academic freedom is a sacred trust, and it means I have the freedom to teach, and you have the freedom to learn, and you have the freedom to teach. One of the great things about being a teacher is that if you teach in a certain way, you're always a student of your students. That means I never stop learning. I've learned more from my Stateville students, from my U Chicago students, than I could possibly teach them. That's the beauty of the dialectic of teaching and learning.
I want to dive deeper with you on this. I think most listeners, including myself, find what you're saying very compelling. But there's a saying on the street, most people remember, not like, I'm going to add a little bit here, the facts or what you tell them, they remember how you make them feel.
That's right.
And you're certainly speaking to that. I don't want to deny that. It's so obvious. Thank you. What's perplexing is the paradox. The tell me more is, if we see the truth in what you've been just saying, why wouldn't someone behave differently? Why, under oppression, it seems like people feel like they don't have the time nor the space to really identify with other people, to really share and feel like they have a common destiny, a common existence.
Well, I think, you know, I think one of the things that's pretty clear is that racial capitalism foregrounds and intensifies and amplifies the individual and de-emphasizes the community. So it takes a back seat. But I think, one of the things I think, David, that is very important is that you can look at the schools and deduce from schools anywhere in any point in history or any part of the world, you can deduce what the society is like. So if you looked at the schools of apartheid South Africa, you would know what apartheid is because you see small classrooms with state-of-the-art equipment for 12 white kids in a class, European kids, and a school for African kids with 60 kids in a class and a broken roof and no textbook, So you can see what the society is by looking at the
That's
school.
very real, by the way. You mentioned South Africa, but I want to mention in Baltimore and Chicago, kids are freezing and having to wear jackets in their classroom.
Exactly. And so you can, or you could look at apartheid South Africa and know that the schools would look that way. The same is true for Nazi Germany or fascist Italy or medieval Saudi Arabia. If you know what the society is, you can guess what the schools are. If you look at the schools, it's important to mention fascist Germany because Nazi Germany, because they produced great intellectuals, great scientists, great athletes, some great artists, and they also produced a society that was willing to turn the other way when people were marched into the gates of hell. And so, the real lessons in those German and Italian classrooms was obedience and conformity. So it makes you want to say to yourself, if obedience and conformity are what's taught in an authoritarian society, what do we teach in a free society? How do we do it? And I think too often in Baltimore and Chicago, we rely on obedience and conformity to the detriment of the arts of liberty, meaning initiative, courage, imagination. And any institution in a free society would foreground initiative, courage, and courage. It would applaud imagination and creativity. Nonconformity and noncompliance would be respected, and so on. But those aren't the qualities we see in too many of our schools, especially schools for the poor, schools for African-ancestored people, schools for immigrants from poor countries. These schools really rely on authoritarian precepts like obedience and conformity. That's a tragedy, and it's a tragedy we're going to pay for.
Well, talking to Bill Ayers, as you can tell, he's a very engaged teacher and also a peace and social justice activist. I imagine many of the listeners know him by reputation. And those who don't, I hope you have found this hour exciting. You're talking about when freedom is the question, abolition is the answer. And we can only do that because each and every quarter, we here at WPFW 89.3 FM ask you to make a donation, to become a member, to make a pledge today. The number is 1-800-222-9739, 1-800-222-9739. Or if you're listening on a smartphone and you have Cash App, $WPFWFM. And for those who listen across the country and in various parts of the world, and I do have those listeners, Bill, on WPFWFM.org, there's a bright red donate button. Our guest has been kind enough to make a donation. An anonymous donor who's a new listener in Cheverly has made a donation. We still need $400 to go. Someone out there can maybe do that whole amount. Or someone out there could take a piece of that financial responsibility that keeps us on the air, keeps 80 plus programmers going, bringing you various programs. For instance, at 3 p.m., 3 to 5, Sophie's Parlor, one of the oldest women collectives on radio, brings you music and culture by women, but for everyone. Zen El Amin at 2 on Shewanana talks about the concerns of Middle Eastern affairs. And at 1 p.m., Moisa Mutale and James Pope bring you Africa Now, African descended people, not only on the continent, but throughout the diaspora, engaging governance, history, environment, political concerns, and the like. And we give you a little break each noon hour during the week. Would Don't forget the blues. I'm always honored to do the lead in for Clarence the Blues Man Turner, 12 noon Eastern Time. All that because you, the listener, choose to participate with us. We don't take that for granted. 47 years speaks to it all, folks. Be a member today. Be a sustaining member. Call 1-800-222-9739. 1-800-222-9739. Or make your donation online through WPFWFM.org, the bright red button, if you please. Thank you in advance. We really appreciate you. Bill, we've gotten to a certain juncture here, and you take on something head on in the chapter called Freedom, Anarchism, and Socialism. And that S word is such a dreaded word in the mainstream. We talk about conditioning, it really hits people's buttons. I'm just going to be direct with you. What are you trying to cover in that essay?
What I'm saying is that I'm partly saying that anarchism has gotten so is socialism, and you know when you think about it, I start that essay by talking about a visit I had in Greece with Manolis Glaisos, one of the heroes of Europe. He was 14 years old when he took the Nazi flag off the Acropolis, and he was on the run, arrested, 10 years in prison, off and on, was tortured. But I met Manolis when he was 90 years old, and he was a marvelous guy, and I could tell you more about it, but I'll just say this, that when we were walking back to the boat that had brought me to his small island out far in the archipelago, he said to me, "You know, Bill, I think we have the same problem here in Greece that you have in the US, and that is that we get in our minds that we can't function without authority figures. We think we need a mayor and a chief of police, somebody to guide us, when actually, if we had the confidence, we can take care of our own affairs, mutual aid, solidarity, common sense." So I posit the kind of picture of the traditional picture of the anarchist in a dark, heavy overcoat running down the street with a sizzling black bomb in his arms. And I say, no, that's a funny image, but it's not real. What's real is think about a large, slightly off-kilter family, or think about a large, lovely daycare center. It's filled with errors and mistakes and stupidities and so on. But somehow we take care of each other. Somehow we look to each other to solve problems. And I think that that's the kind of way I want to think about it. The other piece, socialism, I argue in the essay that freedom without socialism is predation and exploitation, but socialism without freedom is slavery and captivity. You know, you need somehow this balance, but socialism means simply that we identify what is in our collective goodwill and we push the collective efforts and resources to solve those problems. Obviously, highways are socialist. I always argue with my right-wing friends and so on, that they rode the socialist highway up to get to the meeting, you know, because you don't pay a toll on the local streets. It's just, we
At
agreed.
least for a little while, unless you're, I'm thinking of a certain southern state where you pay a toll every few minutes then.
Privatize everything. Let's remember, garbage pickup in Chicago is a socialist enterprise. And frankly, I don't want it private. I don't want you to decide whether your garbage should be picked up. I want us to agree that all the garbage should be picked up. That's the kind of thing. And so, if it's true for garbage and it's true for streets, why can't it be true for a robust rail system? Why can't it be true for healthcare? Why can't it be true for education? Education, part of the reason the right wing hates education, public schools, is because they're public, because they're paid for by the public. Now, with all the flaws, you know, this poor community doesn't, because it's based on property tax, doesn't get the resources that this rich community gets. And that's telling about the society we live in. But the important thing is, we should have public schools. It should be a human right that every kid, by dint of being born, has access to a forward-looking, fully resourced education within reach, not that he has to reach for in some way, but one you can walk to. That's a socialist kind of ideal.
Well, this hour has been full, and like when I saw you in Baltimore, people know that they project at you that you have some secret sauce, pardon me, pardon my accent, about organizing. And within a week's time, to be kind of cheesy and dramatic, the fate of the world could easily change given a certain election. A word about organizing and moving forward. We have about less than 2 to 3 minutes, really.
Well,
Unfair, I know. I'm sorry.
the election question, and part of what I'm doing on this book tour is going to youth communities, independent bookstores, mostly in swing states. I think it's very important that folks vote. I understand all the reasons not to vote. But I can hold in my mind two contradictory ideas. The lesser of two evils is still evil, and the lesser of two evils is still lesser. So the question about voting and organizing. I feel like organizing is very much like teaching. You knock on a door, you assume the person who answers that door is a full human being. You learn from that person as well as teach that person. And you try to build within that a sense of community and a sense of common purpose. But we can organize 365 days a year. I can be an activist 365 days a year. It takes me 15 minutes to vote. And the reason I think it's important, I mean, there are many reasons, and I know all the reasons not to vote. But I think the reason to vote is because it's not a moral issue, it's a practical issue. It's not a Valentine, it's a test group. It's not voting for your friend, it's voting for your next opponent. And so I can vote, and I can vote for the lesser of two evils. And a good example of why one should do that is the Dobbs decision. Dobbs, you can say it's Tweedledum and Tweedledummer, it is. There's only an inch between the two bourgeois parties. That's true. But that a lot of important people, vulnerable people, live within that inch. And so I'm going to vote. I worked with people arm to arm, with people who died for the right to vote, Goodman, Shmuel, Cheney, SNCC. I also know all over the world, people are literally dying to vote. I'm going to vote. I also know the ways in which it's phony and inadequate, but I'm going to do it because people die for it, because it's a blood debt, because it will make a difference. Small as that difference is, get right out the next day after you vote and organize. Organize an irresistible social movement to bring about the real changes that we need in this country and in this world.
Bill Ayres, thank you. Time well spent. Every moment. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, David. I appreciate you very much.
My thanks to the listeners for sticking with us in this hour, for continuing to support WPFW for more than 47 years. The show's coming to an end. We have $300 to go. Someone or someones, as in many, can make that difference. Won't you please become a member today by calling 1-800-222-9739. 1-800-222-9739. We need you. I need you. The station needs you. And we need to continue jazz and justice beyond our 47 years. Become a member today. And I thank you. My thanks to Mike Nasella, our engineer, and to the News and Public Affairs Department of WPFW. To the other programmers who work so hard, who give you both joy and truth, thank you. And listeners, thank you. Thank you for being with us. Thank you for spreading the word and telling others. Again, you can still continue to donate even as the show is finishing up, as the news is about to come on, and then Clarence the Bluesman Turner will join you with the blues. Have a great day. And again, thank you for being with us. Take good care.
this new moon. So the